And welcome to the first episode of the Historic Present podcast, hosted by myself, Charlie Gordon, and my good friend and co-host, Jonah Howe. Jonah.
Hello.
Hello.
Thank you very much for that, Charlie. So, like you said, my name is Jonah Howe, and this is the first ever episode of the longly anticipated Historic Present podcast. Charlie and I have always loved history. Currently doing GCSE History in Year 11, we have always wanted to take our passion for the subject further. So it is our aim to create a mainly historical podcast, as the name suggests, with a touch of modern day political discussions. We shall begin with early 20th century Europe, looking at the end of the First World War. We will delve deep into post-war Germany and the transition from a democratic to dictatorship state. We will then uncover the events of World War II, before looking at the Cold War, leading us up to the start of the 21st century. With every episode, we will leave a short section at the end for a brief political debate, covering the media's recent hot topics. Essentially, the historic present is our present to you. We hope you enjoy listening to our historical and political discussions as much as we enjoy making them. Charlie, let's begin. Let's set the scene. It's the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month of 1918. The boom of the artillery comes to a stop. For the first time in 4 years, there is silence across the Western Front in France. The brutal horrors of the First World War have finally ended. Horrors that were by far the worst events mankind had ever seen. 8.5 million casualties suffered. So, what happens next? Europe, as it is in turmoil. Like I said, all these millions of deaths, all these hundreds of thousands of acres of land destroyed, economies in absolute turmoil. Something's gotta happen. Decisions are gonna have to be made. Pens have to be put on paper. So, what does happen next? In step, three nations. Three allied nations, three victorious nations. The USA, Britain, and France. Charlie, who's the leader of France at this time?
Georges Clemenceau.
Britain?
Lloyd George. Or David Lloyd George is his full name.
And the USA.
All hail the Lord President Woodrow Wilson.
President Woodrow Wilson. So we have these three, or as they're known, the big three. Clemenceau.
Yeah.
Lloyd George. And President Woodrow Wilson, representing France, Britain, and the USA, respectively.
Yeah.
Now, what made these jobs, the jobs of the big three, so important? Well, essentially, the future of Europe and the future of the world lay in the hands of these three people. What decisions did they take? Well, who are the...
I think...
Who are the losing nations in this war? We have Germany, we have Austria, we have Hungary, we have Turkey, and they all have to be dealt with. So Charlie, I ask you this. Let's take Austria, first of all. What decisions were taken to deal with Austria at the end of the First World War?
Yeah, well, I think also, as you said, you're missing out on Bulgaria there, actually.
Oh, well, I apologize. No.
Should be very sorry.
I am.
Say sorry.
I'm sorry.
Okay. Yeah, so we start with Austria, the Treaty of Saint-Germain. Discuss what the treaty meant for Austria, a losing nation. So, first of all, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, great historical empire, powerful for centuries on end, had been broken up between Austria and Hungary. And the land was redistributed to form succession states. So we've got Bohemia and Moravia, which was given to Czechoslovakia, Bosnia and Herzegovina, and Croatia were given to Yugoslavia. And much of the Austrian industry also went to Czechoslovakia as well, causing mass economic problems for Austria themselves. And and also, I think one thing people often forget is Italy, another winning nation, thought she should have got more Austrian territory than she did.
Right, should we move on from Austria? Let's move on from Austria. Who should we go to next?
I think Hungary, Jonah. Hungary.
Okay, let's go on to Hungary.
So, we're going to look at the Treaty of Trianon involving Hungary. Look, Transylvania, province of Transylvania, given to Romania, Ania. Slovakia and Ruthenia were given to Czechoslovakia.
We've got lots of new nations here, like, don't we?
It's loads of new nations. And that's the most brilliant part about it. But, you know, we'll find out what happens next. Slovenia given to Yugoslavia. And we've got 3 million Hungarians, by no fault of their own, ending up in different states.
It's almost as if we're in the butchers. And there's this great butcher's knife.
Yeah.
And Europe is a massive piece of meat. And it's just being sliced up and carved
up.
And this bit over there, and this little chunk of meat down there, is being sliced apart. And, well, it's only for fair minds to judge whether this was a good decision or not.
Well, it is for fair minds to judge. And before we move on, I think let's talk about Trianon. So we've got industry and raw materials of Hungary that were lost. They were supposed to pay reparations, but, you know, post-war economy was as weak as it was, and especially Hungary, they didn't actually ever pay the reparations in the end, even though, I mean, I think we can think about, this is another sort of way we can look at the Allies perhaps being too demanding of these countries. It is too hot.
How can you expect a country that's just gone through a horrifying war, losing how many lives, who spent so much on their war effort? You can't expect them.
Well, of course, the argument on the British and on the Allied side is that why this war happened in the first place. They need to be paid back. They won the war. Yeah. The others lost in their heads. And also, we have to remember the big three were under huge pressure from people at home as well.
Yeah, we will get onto the aims of the big three a bit later.
Yeah.
But now let's go on to the decision. What treaty should we look at next? Neuilly?
Treaty of Neuilly. Bulgaria. This is fairly simple. They lost land to Greece, Romania, and Yugoslavia.
More land lost.
Access to the Mediterranean, cutting off their corridor for trading with other countries. I mean, same story, reparations. But they were treated less harshly than the others because, you know, they didn't have a massive part in the war, to be honest. I mean, they're fairly irrelevant.
Yeah. Like, I mean, calling them irrelevant is a step far above the job.
I mean, do you know what? They're relevant to an extent, but...
Should we touch on Sèvres?
Sèvres, yeah. Oh, Turkey. The formal acceptance of the breakup of the Ottoman Empire. Another historic empire butchered up into pieces, such as, you know, Egypt given to Britain, as well as Syria, Tunisia, and Morocco, all handed kindly over to France. And they lost control of the straits connecting to the Mediterranean and the Black Sea as well. So again, more sort of, you know, loss of access to the sea, huge. The sea was back then, and then without airplanes, commercial airplanes, it was huge because you need to get, I was going to trade, you know, without boats. It's just crazy for them. And
100%.
You know, the Turks at home were outraged, and the treaty was challenged by a Turkish nationalist led by a geezer called Mustafa Kemal.
A geezer?
And be renegotiated as the Treaty of Lausanne in 1923. I mean, what do we think, Jonah? Think odd, Sam.
Yeah, so let's look at the bigger picture here. We've got massive powers within Europe who have been carved up and, I'd say, rather harshly dealt with.
Yeah, but I mean,
we are yet to touch on Germany, and that is what we will do now. But first, I want to delve deeper into the big three. Like I said, Clemenceau representing France, Lloyd George representing Britain, and Wilson representing the US. So, Charlie, let's focus first on Clemenceau representing France.
I agree.
What was his attitude towards Germany at the end of the war?
So Clemenceau, much like many people in his country, was incredibly angry at Germany and the Axis powers because of the damage suffered to the French land as most of the fighting took place in the Western Front, in the trenches, with much of the, you know, the land in France in minefields and, you know, scattered with dead bodies. It really was just chaos and turmoil. And
I think France suffered 6 million casualties, the most of any of the three nations, more than Britain and USA combined. So they were rightfully angry towards Germany. Anyway, continue.
Of course. Well, I think that's why Clemenceau had the attitude of, we need to make Germany pay.
Them pay. So would you say that was his main aim going into the...
Yeah, 100%. I mean, he was the one that wanted all the reparations, mainly just because he was so intent on punishing Germany and also taking up their lands.
Yeah. Let's now move on to Woodrow Wilson representing the USA. Well, now, if you imagine a sort of spectrum between these big three, you got, at one end, you got Clemenceau, who has the absolute harshest attitude towards Germany. And some say fairly so. After all, the fighting had taken place in France. They had suffered the most casualties. So on the complete other end, we have Woodrow Wilson. He is by far more lenient and less harsh than France and Britain due to the fact that the USA suffered far less casualties and, of course, didn't suffer any damage caused to their land, as, of course, they are thousands of miles away across the pond. They were far less likely to seek revenge than Britain and France. So what did Wilson want? Well, essentially, Wilson's main aim was to reestablish national self-determination, which was the right of nations to rule themselves rather than be under foreign rule. So he would want to see an end to the Austrian-Hungarian Empire, the end to the Ottoman Empire, even the end to British international territories, which would obviously have angered Britain. Woodrow Wilson also released a list of 14 aims. Now, these aims famously included terms such as free navigation across international seas, free trade between countries, and a worldwide reduction in weapons and arms. Woodrow Wilson was clearly a pacifist. He was clearly an idealist. He wanted peace. Yeah, he wanted the world to forget what had happened, give everyone a clean slate, and say, you know what, guys? We're friends.
All friends.
Could this mindset of a political leader work in advancing things?
No.
I don't think so. Now, let's focus in on Lloyd George and Britain.
Yeah. Well, Lloyd George was the middle ground between France and the USA. His sort of agenda was to punish Germany, but not as harshly as France wanted to. And he, as well as Wilson, wanted to prevent German revenge and allow Germany to be a trading partner with England. He knew that it would be very important to them in the future, so he wanted to maintain a good relationship.
Yeah, well, before the war, Germany was one of Britain's largest trading partners. So to rebuild the German economy and start trading with Germany again was essential for Britain.
Of course, definitely. And I think David Lloyd George himself knew there were certain things he had to do. So he wanted to confiscate the German colonies and the navy, which was really for his own interest to strengthen the British Empire. And which was what Britain always prided themselves on, was their imperial sort of power across the world. I mean, before World War II, Britain was the main superpower in the world, and they had colonies all over the world. And their navy, obviously, something that was considered something hugely patriotic for Britons. And, you know, Lloyd George himself was a realist, and he knew there would have to be a compromise. He knew that it couldn't be Woodrow Wilson's sort of ideal or fancy, you know, peace. Just never 100%. Could have, he knew it just wouldn't happen. 100%. With Clemenceau.
So there we have it. We've gone deep into the aims and the attitudes of the big three, Clemenceau, Lloyd George, and Wilson. So I just want to give you a quote by historian Guy Cuthbertson of Liverpool Hope University, who I think really summarizes the intent of the Allied nations going into the Treaty of Versailles, where, of course, Germany's fate was decided. "The Allies wouldn't have given Germany better terms because they felt that they had to defeat Germany, and Germany could not be allowed to get away with it," Cuthbertson said. "There's also a sense that an armistice has to ensure that the enemy are not strong enough to start the war again anytime soon." So there's this real sense that the big three have to come together, form a decision that is not too harsh on Germany, but then again, must ensure that Germany, and of course the other losing nations, never repeat these events ever again.
No, of course. It's a fine line as well when you think about it, how we have the benefit of hindsight here, and we know what happened, right? As historians and, you know, people who enjoy history, we understand, you know, what happened and what they shouldn't have done and what they should have done. But, you know, when we take away the element of hindsight, we need to think about what was going through the minds of the big three, and it leads us to what the public mood was like in 1919.
So we've gone deep into the aims and attitudes of the big three, and we've began to create a picture of what Europe looks like at the end of the First World War. Now we are going to go deep into the Treaty of Versailles, perhaps one of the most famous treaties at the end of the First World War, which famously dealt with the fate of Germany. So who was present at the Treaty of Versailles? Like we've already said, Clemenceau representing France, Lloyd George, representing Britain, and President Woodrow Wilson, Lord Woodrow Wilson, representing the United States of America. Rather importantly, Germany were not present at the Treaty of Versailles. Germany had no say in their own fate.
Well, none of the Axis powers had any say in their treaties either. It's important to remember.
So now let's get into the main terms of the Treaty of Versailles. Charlie, talk to me about the guilt clause.
The war guilt clause, I mean, it's fairly simple. Article 231 of the treaty, Germany accepting blame for starting the war. And it's not just that itself, but it's far deeper. We, you know, it's national pride is on the line, and the German public feel humiliated. You know, we didn't start the war. I mean, it sounds like madness, and the first word that comes to mind for Germans when they think of this treaty is a diktat, a dictation. It's something they never had a say in, and it's something that they just felt humiliated by.
Yeah, clause 231 was humiliating. Germany, up until this point, had been this massive, strong, proud nation whose military was a huge sense of their national pride. And now accepting the blame for this war, what? Many Germans didn't actually believe they had lost the war. That sounds shocking, but if you think about it, German land had never been invaded. No foreign soldier had stepped a foot inside Germany. So how could they lose a war without losing any land? That was quite absurd to many Germans. However,
of course,
this treaty did make them lose land. Charlie.
Yes.
What land did they lose?
German territory lost Alsace-Lorraine, given France.
In a region of eastern Germany bordering France.
Yes. Yes, that's right. That's right. Often disputed as well between the two nations over the years. Eupen and Malmedy was given to Belgium. Don't really know much about it. Nordschleswig given to Denmark, later to be given back, however, in a plebiscite, which we'll, I'm sure, come on to. Saarland was won by the League for 15 years, and then a plebiscite as well, given back to Germany. West Prussia and Posen were given to Poland, also known as, known as the Polish Corridor. Upper Silesia, given to Poland. Danzig, made a free city, run by the League of Nations, which you'll touch upon later, Jonah.
Yeah.
And an Anschluss, or union. The Anschluss was the German word for a union between Germany and Austria, and that was just forbidden by the Allies.
So just there, you got a huge list of all these territories on the east of Germany, west of Germany, north of Germany, and south of Germany, all taken away from Germany.
They lost so much land. It's unbelievable.
They really did.
Look at
And it's not just land. Of course, living in these lands are, of course, Germans. And so these Germans are now under new foreign rule. The outrage that would happen if that happened today in the UK, if suddenly all Londoners were declared under French rule, we would not sit there and accept it.
No.
So this is all brewing ingredients for a second war.
Yeah.
Let's move on. Let's talk about disarmament, Charlie.
Yes. So, yeah, demilitarization. Their army was limited to 100,000 men. Conscription, really important, conscription was banned. So, no one could be employed by the army, Germany, all volunteers. And this was huge.
Famously abused by Adolf Hitler later on.
Well, yes, we'll come on to that. The rise of Hitler. No armored vehicles, no submarines, no aircraft, no heavy artillery, and only six battleships. And
yeah.
As I mentioned before, the demilitarization of the Rhineland was brought upon because the Rhineland bordered Germany and France together, and France wanted a demilitarized buffer zone between them and Germany to stop a German invasion of France anytime soon.
It was a layer of safety. It was a security measure. They had been invaded once,
and that was occupied.
Yeah.
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 That was occupied by Allied troops.
Yeah.
Carry on.
So we've covered the guilt clause, we've covered the disarmament, which of course was one of Woodrow Wilson's main aims, and we've covered territory loss. What about reparations, Charlie?
Yeah, reparations. Exact figure was fixed to £6.6 billion. And that is just an obscene amount of money. I mean, that's like modern day equivalent. We're talking trillions. I mean, that is just...
Not quite trillions, like, but trillions,
but that was a bit of a... Hyperbole.
A shocking fact, these reparations were to be paid in installments until 1984. Can you think of the progress we've made from 1920 to 1984, a time during which Germany should have still been paying reparations from the First World War? Of course, it didn't happen.
It's a different story, as we know.
Okay, so an obscene amount of reparations. Was it too harsh? Was it not? Again, sparks another debate. However, this was...
About colonies?
Yeah, well, we sort of touched that on the loss of territories, but of course, overseas territories, as...
Germany, South Africa, Cameroon given to France, New Guinea given to Australia, and Samoa was given to New Zealand, and was basically given to the League, I say that in inverted commas, controlled by Britain. That's pretty much the main kind of that's the main kind of terms of the treaty.
Also, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia were declared countries. So, Charlie, I propose you this question.
Yes, Jonah.
Did the Treaty of Versailles, with its intention to create peace and to ensure a war would never happen again of this scale, with all that said, did the Treaty of Versailles actually contain all the perfect ingredients for the start of another war?
Well, I think, good question there, Joan. And I will respond to that with some evidence. So let's talk about how Germany reacted to the Treaty of Versailles. Germany lost 10% of its land, 12.5% of its population, 16% of its coalfields, 50% of its iron and steel industry, and 100% of its overseas colonies. Like I said, it's just so much has been lost. Reps destroyed the economy, war guilt clause hated, disarmament upsetting German pride, its military military tradition, as with also no allied powers disarmed. They felt that was unfair. Territorial losses, anger in Germany. They were treated as they were defeated power. The stab in the back myth. Now, that's really something we can come on to later and talk more about. There was anger that Germany was represented at the talks and the treaty was a diktat, as I place emphasis on that word, diktat. It really was, they felt it was just, them being told what to do. And they felt there was also double standarding as well from the Allies. There was self-determination for some, such as Poland, Czechoslovakia, Austria, but disarmament, but only for Germany were not allowed self-determination, and they were not allowed to join the League of Nations. And just the perfect ingredients for vengeance and revenge for Germany to come back perhaps stronger. Although, obviously, we have the benefit of hindsight. Yeah. The Allies at the time obviously didn't.
Exactly. So there was quite rightly deserved outrage from Germany. Like you said, Wilson's idea of international disarmament, he's forced Germany to disarm, but where's the cooperation from France and Britain? They very unwillingly disarmed, and they disarmed to such a small extent that it was almost pitiful towards Germany. Real outrage sparked in Germany.
Yeah, definitely.
Which maybe could have led to a Second World War. The beauty of hindsight.
Well, we don't... Of course.
And finally, one more wish from Woodrow Wilson was delivered. The League of Nations was set up. But the League of Nations is not too dissimilar from the United Nations of today. It was a structured organization that set about to bring international cooperation and restore peace between countries. Now, I'll touch a little bit on the structure of the League of Nations. The League of Nations had different committees which all worked on a separate part of international goals. One such committee was the Slavery Commission, which worked to abolish world slavery. The Health Committee, which attempted to deal with the problem of dangerous diseases and to educate people about health and sanitation. And the Refugees Committee, hundreds of thousands of people fled from the areas of conflict, and it was their aim to sort, in inverted commas, them out. The Assembly was the League of Nations Parliament. Now, essentially, every country sent a representative to the Assembly. However, rather importantly, Germany were not invited to the League of Nations when it was first set up. So in this assembly, countries could recommend actions to the council. They could vote on admitting new members to the league. However, they only met once a year. And a further weakness, decisions made had to be unanimous. So you can already tell it's quite hard for the league to make decisions. The council, which I just mentioned, was a smaller group that met more often than the Assembly, 5 times a year. They had permanent members, Britain, France, Italy, and Japan. These nations had vetoes, meaning they could overrule any bill that the League wanted to pass. Temporary members could be voted in for 3 years. The Council had powers. These powers would be used by the Council if a country breached the compliances of the League. So these powers were moral condemnation, a rather firm telling off. Charlie, stop. If that didn't work, economic and financial sanctions. Charlie, pay up. I do not like the repeat of this behavior. I demand you pay a fine. And finally, military force. Charlie, you've been told off.
Yeah.
You've paid a fine. And now I'm going to invade. If that didn't work, then I suppose a fully declared war. So this is just a brief introduction to the League of Nations. We will go further into this organization later on when we discuss the events of the 1930s. So that concludes our history section for today's episode. We will now swiftly move on to a brief political discussion. Okay, Charlie, I'm going to straight away chuck you into the deep end and put you on the political hot seat, and I'm going to fire some questions at you and spark some debates, okay?
Okay.
First off, I want to talk about how disgusted I am with the UK media and their portrayal of Marcus Rashford over the past few weeks. Would you like to, first off, elaborate your views on this situation?
Yeah, I mean, I personally agree with what you're saying. I think the media portrayed Marcus Rashford terribly. After all the work he's done, after all the money he has ploughed into helping out young kids and families with free school meals and free meals over holiday. And just because, you know, the geezer's on $200,000 plus a week, right? He's bought himself some nice houses, property, and yet he gets slated for it. I mean, the guy has done everything he can for people that came from a similar sort of background that he did, and yet the media, especially the Sun and the Mirror and all these newspapers, just looking for stories. I just think it's very poor for media. I really highly respect Marcus Rashford, not just as a footballer but also as a person, as I'm sure many people do, considering what he's done.
Yeah, and I'm going to have to agree with you on this. All the hard work he's done, working or trying to work closely with the government, and then the headline story, Marcus Rashford buys 5 multi-million pound properties. You know, putting him under the classic footballer.
Well, what else is he going to do with his money? Like, bathing it? Bathing it? You know, is he going to, I don't know what else he'd do with it. No. Worth it.
Yeah, well, okay. Charlie, the US, we've all been hearing about it. The US election finished a few weeks ago. Well, it should have finished, but still going on.
Well,
Biden won. I don't know how to phrase this exactly, because he won the election, but he
hasn't won
Trump's approval. Yet. Let's put it that way. I just want to get your thoughts on Trump's actions and what Biden could possibly do and the message America is putting out right now to the rest of the world.
Yeah, I think Trump's sort of inability and his desire to not concede the election really democracy itself, it puts a bad name on democracy, and it kind of shows America as a place where, you know, it's meant to be the most, we see it as the most sort of free place in the world, free speech. You can be whatever you want to be. I say that in inverted commas as well, but it kind of just ruins the view of America based on Trump, a selfish and arrogant man who does not, is quite simply a sore loser. He is a sore loser.
What he's doing is he's inciting violence within the American people. He's encouraging.
Yes. He's encouraging divide, polarization.
To go out and rally, spark violence. Yes. He's encouraging it. And this.
Because, you know, because I think he as a person is someone who just cannot take loss. And I think for Biden, this is difficult for Biden. It's a difficult situation for him because there's not a massive amount he can do. And considering, you know, the Supreme Court with it having, I think, six Republican justices and three Democratic justices, there's a clear sort of outweigh in terms of political opinion. But bear in mind, I mean, electoral fraud is something that very rarely happens. And it just seems absurd. And all these, you know, these Democratic conspiracies, QAnon, you know, it isn't democratic.
Well, one thing's for sure, the America of 2020 is nothing like the America of 2016.
No.
The America that Trump took over. We will always remember Donald Trump as an egotistical, selfish, hilarious, not in a good way, politician. He has changed the world's view on America.
Well,
and I think he's permanently changed it.
Pardon?
I think he's permanently changed the world's view on America. It will be very hard for Biden, for the Biden administration to change reputation, which Trump has now built up. And, you know, before 2020, Trump hadn't had the worst term of any US president.
No. But successes.
It is the tweets, it is the public remarks during speeches, it's the all these comments he makes.
He makes things so personal against people, you know, like he's not a politician. He's not afraid to just rat out people and basically chat shit about people behind their back, well, not behind their back, in front of everyone to humiliate people. That's just a terrible trait to have, especially as a world-renowned politician. I just don't know how they managed to get him to have power.
Well, I was looking into a CNN report earlier today, and it's gone deep into all the actions the Trump administration has taken to eventually make the Biden administration job harder. So I'll just read you some of the points on this, actions that Trump has made. So he has further removed troops from Afghanistan and Iraq in the final days of his presidency.
Yeah.
He's planning a last minute crackdown on China. He's contemplating new terrorist designations in Yemen that could complicate efforts to broker peace. He's floating the idea of a last-minute military strike on Iran, according to the New York Times.
Yeah.
He's building a wall of sanctions that make it difficult for Biden to rejoin the Iran nuclear deal Trump scuttled. Yeah. It's just all these different things that supposedly, you know, believe it. We're assuming that this.
Well, he's
is
trying
true.
To do Biden in. It's clear. He's just trying to.
He's not going down without a fight.
No, he's doing it systematically, and he knows. But if he is going to go, he's going to. And that is kind of, for me, it kind of shows the peak and the epitome of his selfishness and his outlook on the world, which is me. It's only about him. And he doesn't care about the benefit of America. And yeah, What do you think?
Well, it's a tough one. What about Biden? Will he really be what America need right now?
No.
No?
But he's a better op. No, I don't. I think he has the. I think a lot of people say, you know, he's too old. I think he just doesn't have the strength that it takes to be the leader of one of the most the most powerful geopolitical countries in the world right now. I just don't think he's got that in him. I can see Kamala Harris definitely by the next term running instead of him, in my opinion, as to be the first woman president.
What I can see Biden doing is calming the storm.
Yeah.
I think America needs to take one big deep breath. 2020 has been an awful, awful year for America. Awful.
Yeah.
Coronavirus. The outrage over Black Lives Matter. And I think Biden, his first task in the Oval Office is to sort this stuff out.
Yeah.
Now, I don't think he should fund the police force more, which supposedly he will. But, you know, that's going on a completely other tangent. But I just think that Biden has the ability to, and he will do, bring a certain level of stability to the United States. And that is the most necessary thing they need as a country right now.
Yes, I agree.
From a UK point of view, Biden and Boris Johnson, they don't get on that well, to be honest. There has always been, obviously, a long-lasting friendship between the White House and Downing Street. But, I don't know, from Biden's point of view, when he's looking to trade in Europe, he's looking at Paris and France. He's looking at Germany and the strength of Merkel. Looking at Belgium and Brussels and the European market potentials that has. He's obviously Irish, so we'll be looking there. But I don't think that with all this uncertainty still over Brexit and how our markets are going to look like, I think this might be the first time in a long time where the relationship between the President of the United States and the Prime Minister of the UK goes a bit sour.
Yeah, I mean, my take on it is I don't know enough about I don't know if there's history between Boris and Biden. I know that Boris is far more right on the political spectrum than Biden. But I still, you know, Biden, relative to Britain, is still on the right. Even though in America, he's considered on the left. By our standards, he's right. So I think that, you know, I think Biden will try to trade the UK, but I don't think that's his main priority at the moment. I think his main priority is COVID and getting his own country sorted out. Much like when America went into a period of isolation following the Great Depression.
Okay, well, I'm not really sure what you've just said, but I like the way you've said it.
And that concludes the first episode of the Historic Present podcast, brought to you by myself, Charlie, my co-host, Jonah. If you want to make any suggestions to us regarding our political sections, any questions, you can tweet us at CharlieGFFC and
at JonahHow3.
Yeah, so that wraps it all up. We hope you thoroughly enjoyed this and found it very informative and interesting, and we both very much enjoyed making it. Thank you all.
See you next time.